This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available real-time traffic alerts. More at acura.com/RDX.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, we use the funny new feature film, The TV Set, to show how TV pilots fight their way to the little screen. Plus, we talk to the agent turned author of Hollywood Girls Club, the deliciously salacious and sometimes true novel about women and power in Hollywood. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Yoga Booty Ballet can wait. It's The Business from NPR. We will not start the caravan with any news about Don Imus, but we will offer a prediction. The recently fired radio and TV curmudgeon will sign a multi-million-dollar deal with satellite radio before the year is done. We're not saying it's right. We're just saying it's going to happen. Elsewhere, the Beatles may finally be going online. Tracks from the Fab Four should soon be available via download services such as iTunes now that a long-running royalty dispute has been settled. AppleCorp, the company owned by Paul, Ringo, and the heirs of John and George, had sued record company EMI over millions in disputed royalties in 2005. Last week, they settled. AppleCorp will now be free to negotiate a new royalties deal with EMI that extends to online music downloads, paving the way for the Fab Four to once again rule the charts, this time via the web. In other music news, three of Michael Jackson's older siblings, Tito, Jermaine, and LaToya, last week made a deal with CBS to host an American Idol-style ripoff called Pop Dynasty. The show purports to find the next big family singing act. We'd like to see Jackson Papa Joe Jackson featured in the Simon Cowell role. But instead of verbally abusing the contestants, he could actually spank and whip them. Speaking of abusers, Comcast, the nation's largest cable operator, announced last week it was buying the online movie ticketing service Fandango. They'll also start a new website for watching TV and movies online, cleverly called Fancast. Launching this summer, Fancast will allow users to watch on-demand shows via television, the internet, and on iPods. But why start up a new content website when there are already so many successful sites locking up content? In fact, the Wall Street Journal reported last week that CBS has struck a bevy of deals to distribute TV shows and other video programming to various web portals, including MSN and AOL. It's also expected to announce an agreement with the new video site Juiced, making it the first broadcast network to sign there. Elsewhere, back in 2001, actress Elizabeth Hurley announced that she was pregnant by Hollywood producer Steve Bing, only to have him question whether he was, in fact, the baby's father. The British tabloids branded him Bing Laden, as in laden with child, and the Daily Mail of London reported that his Los Angeles lawyer had hired private eye to the stars Anthony Pelicano to dig up dirt and destroy Miss Hurley's reputation. But after Bing complained the newspaper report was false and his legal team got Pelicano to sign a declaration to that effect, the Daily Mail issued a retraction, and it reached a financial settlement that Mr. Bing's lawyers called substantial. Cut to last week, when the New York Times reported that federal investigators have discovered evidence that Mr. Bing may indeed have hired Pelicano to investigate Hurley. The Daily Mail may try to recover its costly settlement. We bring the caravan to a grinding halt with news that Lothario Joe Francis has been indicted for federal tax evasion. The creator of the Girls Gone Wild oeuvre of softcore art films reportedly deducted more than $20 million in false business expenses. IRS officials say they were tipped off when they found receipts for almost $4 million worth of tequila and $600,000 worth of limes listed under the heading of quiet business lunches. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up next, like hundreds of baby sea turtles struggling towards the freedom of the waves, TV pilot hatchlings fight to make it to the airwaves, and their chance of survival just as grim. Each winter, the major television networks commission hundreds of scripts for television pilots. Each spring, a small fraction of those scripts are produced. Of those produced pilots, approximately a quarter are picked up and put on the fall schedule. The rest never see the light of day. That's not from a book about network TV, but the opening of a hilarious new indie release from Think Film called The TV Set, written and directed by Jake Kasdan. The movie follows a would-be TV show as it rushes through the winding river of network absurdities to, hopefully, make it to the small screen. In the childhood game of telephone, the original message gets twisted and mangled until it comes to mean something the original speaker never intended. In the grown-up, high-stakes game of television, the writer's original creative vision often meets the same fate, if he or she is lucky. Most TV pilots, of course, never make it that far. As we speak, this scenario is being played out in the real Hollywood. Pilots are being produced for shows that you may or may not see in the fall. And since it's unlikely that any of the actual networks would allow us unfettered behind-the-scenes access, we thought we'd use the TV set to take you into the sausage factory. Because while the movie may be a comedy, and a funny one at that, it's also painfully accurate. One of the first, most important steps of producing a pilot is casting. In the TV set, producer Mike Klein, played by a bearded David Duchovny, has whittled the leads for his new show, The Wexler Chronicles, and now it's time to audition them in front of a room full of network suits.
All right, all right, all right. It's great to be back in the fourth floor conference room. Yeah, well, it's been a busy week over the Wexler Chronicles. A whole lot of casting going on. And so today I thought maybe we'd kick it off by looking at two lovely actresses who represent two very different but equally exciting alternatives for the role of Amanda. And then we're going to look at a couple potential Rob Wexlers. So it's all very exciting stuff. Yeah, I can feel the electricity in the room. Anyway, without any further ado, let's get this party started, okay? Please, a warm fourth floor conference room welcome for the lovely Jessie Fillmore. Jessie?
Thank you.
There she is. Whenever
Hi.
You're ready.
Oh,
Hi.
Okay, thank you. Is that you, Rob Wexler?
Amanda, hi.
Hi, neighbor. Wow. God, it's been a really long time.
In the movie, producer and show creator Mike Klein wants the male lead to go to a young actor who will play the role with quiet dignity. But it's the guy who plays it broad that wows the room.
And now, last but not least, Mr. Zach Harper.
Hi.
Zach Harper, whenever you're ready.
I'm just gonna jump in. Okay.
We had so many terrible teachers.
That's the truth.
Do you remember Mrs. Biedelmeyer? She was the worst.
Do you remember Coach Roberts?
How could I forget Coach Roberts? Talk about delusions of grandeur.
I have this recurring dream about that guy. I'm like 90 years old and I have dentures, except I'm in my high school gym class. And everybody else is the regular high school age. I'm the only one who's 90. And Coach is yelling at me, and I'm going, give me a break. I'm 90 frickin' years old, Holmes. Okay.
After the actors have read, the producer and the executives sit down to talk about what they've seen. It sounds like everyone is just offering their helpful opinion, but in fact, it's a fraught and complex dance of wills.
First of all, let's talk about the role of Amanda, Laurel and Jessie. Now, I thought they both gave very good readings. My instinct is that Laurel is a superb comedian.
Of course, it's the opinions of the people with the wallets that carry the most weight. Here, the head of the fictional PDN TV network is played with a brilliant mix of insanity and sincerity by Sigourney Weaver.
If I could just cut in here, it's true. They're both attractive, but Laurel is also really cute. And I think that's a good thing. She doesn't let her cuteness get in the way of her hotness, and that's really special to me. Also, I think that Jessie has fake breasts, and I believe that over the life of a series, the audience can feel that.
Once casting issues have been resolved, the producer and the execs move on to the story itself. This is the point at which the network's instinct to play it safe and the creative vision of the producer usually collide. Often, the very thing that makes a script stand out as a pilot is what makes it too risky as an actual show. In the film The TV Set, the main issue is whether The Wexler Chronicles will begin with the suicide of the main character's brother.
It's just so sad.
Yeah, I never saw this as a suicide show. I see it more like a guy comes home, the town needs him kind of show. A little northern exposure, a little Ed.
After negotiations about cast and script, it's time to actually shoot the pilot. Bear in mind that the vast majority of pilot ideas, even those the network has bought, will never make it to this point. And unlike feature films, which have a relatively protracted pre-production period, a pilot can go from green light to rolling in a couple of weeks.
Have a nice trip, Mr. Wexler.
Thanks, Carlos. See you Monday.
Hasta luego.
And that would be the cut. Great. Really funny.
After the pilot is finished, it'll go through rigorous, if somewhat risible, audience testing. A note, the following scene from the TV set may seem over the top, but writers we know tell us, if anything, it's probably understatement.
So, we're going to show you a TV show that hasn't even been on the air yet. And then afterwards, I'm going to ask you some questions and find out what you guys thought about it, okay? Now, I'm sure a lot of you guys are thinking, what is this machine in my lap? Well, that is your dial. This is what I'm going to ask you to do. While you're watching the show, I want you to keep your hand on that dial. And if you like something that's happening, then turn it up a little. If you turn it all the way to the right, that's a 10. That means you like what you're watching a whole lot. If you turn all the way to the left, well, that's a 0. See, you understand? Okay, so if you're enjoying what you're seeing, if it's entertaining you, making you laugh or cry or feel something nice, well, then turn it up a little. But if you don't like what you're seeing, if it's making you feel bored or angry or uncomfortable in some way, then turn it down a little.
It's like the volume knob, yo.
Right. It's exactly like a volume knob, yo.
The network then performs a complicated calculus. They weigh all their shows, the new ones that test well and the old programs still holding an audience, and try to plot them into the primetime chessboard. They take into account how they'll grab the audience that'll appeal to advertisers while simultaneously starving the other networks of the same viewers.
And then we have the second season of Screwed at 10 o'clock, which takes care of Friday. Saturday, we do the movie until January, at which point we introduce Stinkin' Rich as a mid-season replacement at 8. Then we have an hour there to double pump whatever needs it, pull an OC if we have to. Sunday, nothing changes.
While the programming people work out the schedule, the marketing folks go to work to figure out how the shows should be pitched to the public, including the title.
Would you watch a show called The Wexler Chronicles?
Well, I don't know. What's it about?
It doesn't matter. If all you knew was the title, would you want to watch it?
Probably not.
How about a show called Rhyme or Reason? What next?
Nah, no way.
Call Me Crazy.
Call Me Crazy? Yeah, I like that, because it's like, you know, the guy's crazy.
After the schedule's been set, the advertisers are invited to what's called the upfronts, where they schmooze with the stars of the shows, are fed piles of shrimp, and listen to pep talks by the network heads.
And this past season has seen growth unprecedented in the history of the network. We've taken what was already a commanding lead in the vital 12 to 22 demo and turned it into a landslide, particularly with women.
Will the Wexler Chronicles make it to the network schedule? If so, will it still be called the Wexler Chronicles? Or Rhyme or Reason? Will the producer have to give away every shred of his dignity and artistic vision to get it on the air? Find out for yourself. The TV set is coming to a theater near you.
As Carla from Slut Wars might say, wowza!
Maggie Marr got her start in the business pushing the mail cart at the mega talent agency ICM and eventually became an agent. Now she's written a novel called Hollywood Girls Club. It's a romp through show business with four female friends, a big-time agent, a superstar actress, a mega producer, and a writer, trying to save a film project from an evil studio head and look fabulous doing it. The business producer Matt Holzman talked to Maggie about what it means to write anything about Hollywood when you're still working in Hollywood.
Maggie Marr, welcome to the business.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
When did you get the idea to write Hollywood Girls Club, and when did you actually start writing it?
I was actually working at ICM when I started writing, and I would do it late at night after I, you know, an agent's life is 24/7 generally. So you would work until 7, 8, 9 o'clock, and then sometimes I would come home and not be able to sleep well. And so I would write for an hour.
So when the people at the agency heard that you were writing a book about Hollywood, what was the initial reaction?
Well, it's very interesting how that all came about, actually. I have a close friend who is now my literary agent, Andy Barsby, who is brilliant and beautiful. And I had written probably about 100, 150 pages. And I thought – and my husband actually pushed me. He was like, you really should give this to someone. And I said, no, I'm an agent and I'm not going to give it to anyone. And he said, I think that you should give it to someone. And I think some people will be surprised to know, but baby agents don't make a lot of money. And I had a daughter who was going to start preschool soon. And I thought to myself, well – if I could sell a book, I could pay for preschool.
Okay, let's go back now. You weren't an agent for babies, but a baby agent meaning somebody junior agent.
Yes, a fairly new agent. So I went ahead and I sent Andy four chapters, and there was a bit of deception there because I didn't put my name on the first four chapters. And it was because we have a working relationship, and I didn't want to taint that because I didn't think anything was going to happen with it. And so if she passed on it, I didn't ever want her to feel badly and put kind of an awkward sort of spin into the relationship. And she called me probably 2 days later, and she said, I've read these four chapters. They're a little rough, but who wrote them? And I said, do you really want to know? And she said, you wrote them. And I said, yes, I did. And she said, well, how far is it? Finish it. I think that I could sell it. And I said, okay, well, I'll finish it. So I finished it, and she sold it. Now, this is the second deception, in that it came out – when she went out to sell it, she put it under a pseudonym. And that was both, I think, to protect me and my career should it not sell so that I could continue just being an agent, which I thought all along was what I would continue to do. And we can get into that later, how the time commitments of both just don't seem to work.
Right.
So she took it out and she sold it. And she sold it for a princely sum, a sum that any person would be feel more than blessed to receive. And it's a credit to her as an agent that she was able to do it, because you've read it and it's a fun read, but it's a fun read. You know, it's not going to win the book award.
Right.
So she went into Esther Newberg's office, who is one of the heads of ICM in the book department. And Esther said to her, she said, Andy, she said, who wrote this? And Andy said, well, I'll tell you who wrote it. It was Margaret. And she said, I think that's just fantastic. So Andy then sent out the memo about a new sale, which is typical for the book department, with my name on it. And it was very surreal because suddenly I had gone from being an agent to being a client. And an agent.
Right.
And the calls were so wonderful from my colleagues. You know, it was when Nancy Josephson was still there. And so she called. And Jeff, of course, because he's
– Jeff Berg.
Yes, he's – He called, and I actually kind of wanted to run and hide because agents like to be behind their clients, and suddenly I was kind of in the center of the mix instead of behind the person who's usually in the center.
Let's take a step back, though. So Nancy Josephson and Jeff Berg, two of the biggest agents in the business,
right.
I think the expectation, especially after reading this book, which is pretty salacious, you know, is that the first thing that would happen would be backstabbing and would be, you know, all these kinds of things. But you're saying people came out in support.
Yes. It was truly wonderful. I received so many calls. Ron Bernstein, Josie Friedman, Jeff Berg, Nancy Josephson. My mentor has always been Nick Reed. I started as an assistant on his desk. When I walked into his office to tell him I think I looked like I was going to be sick, I walked in and I said, Nick, I have to tell you something, because the memo hadn't gone out yet. And I knew there were a few people I needed to tell face-to-face before the email went out. And he said, okay, Maggie, what is it? And I said, well, I've sold a book. He goes, oh, that's great. I think he thought I had sold a book to film or a book to television. I said, no, Nick, I sold a book that I wrote. And he said, what? And he was thrilled, you know, but it was something that I never talked about. It was something that I just did as a hobby. And it just, I was, like I said, I was very lucky that someone liked it and bought it.
Coming up after a short break, more with Maggie Marr, a former ICM agent turned author of the steamy Hollywood Girls Club, a novel. You're listening to The Business from NPR.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. After her long days as an agent with ICM, Maggie Marr would go home and write. The result is Hollywood Girls Club, a novel. A steamy beach read about four powerful women, their careers, their men, and their shoes. The Business producer Matt Holzman continues his conversation with Maggie about what it's like to be a client of the agency you also work for.
So ICM actually repped the book to the publishers. Mm-hmm. Are they now repping the book? Obviously, there's got to be talk about turning it into a film.
Film and television, yes. They're repping the subsidiary rights for the book. So
weird.
It is. It's lovely.
What happens when you walk in the office now to meet with your agent?
Well, do you know, I haven't been in a long time because I did leave as an agent. I think it was 10 months after the book sold. I finally said I don't think I can do both. And I haven't been back. We talk on the phone all the time, but I haven't been in. I always think of my agency, and I know for everyone in the business, they'll probably be shocked, but I always think of them kind of as an extended family in a sense, because the people that I deal with from day to day, I mean, Nick Reed has been generous enough to say that he'll represent me if I ever want to write a screenplay. Well, I was his assistant for 2 years. I know everything about his business. I adore him. Andy Barsby was kind enough to sell my book, and I think she's brilliant at what she does. And I'm just starting to kind of step out into television. So yeah.
All right. Well, okay. So I'm going to just go with you on this, that everyone at the agency has been totally supportive and have said nothing but nice things about you and your work.
To me.
Okay. Very key.
To me.
But what about the flip side of, have people gotten galleys of the book, and have they been looking for things about them, and have they said anything to you because they said, that's my story? Have they been upset that they weren't included in the book or that they were included in the book?
I will tell one story. The day the book sold, as I said, Nancy Josephson called me, and she's one of the best agents in the industry. And she's a great sort of, for women, she's such a mentor, especially as you're coming up, you know, because she president of an agency. She's very good at what she does. She was an attorney first. And she said to me on the phone, she said, I'm the only president of an agency that went to Harvard. And the woman Jessica, who is an agent, went to Harvard. And I said to her, I said, Nancy, I never put those two things together. I said, and I never had really visualized her necessarily as Jessica. And I said, if that is difficult, you know, that can be changed. I can change that. I'd be more than, you know, willing to change. She's like, no, that's fine. She said, you know, and so it wasn't, that was the only time that someone said to me, is that me, in kind of a roundabout way.
I want to ask you about actually writing the book, who you were thinking about when you wrote it, because did you think to yourself, well, gee, I need to write a book about Hollywood that is what the general populace thinks about Hollywood? Or do I write a book about Hollywood the way I've seen it and the way I've experienced it? Or is it some kind of combination of the two?
I think I would say it's a little bit of both, actually, because when I was at the agency, I dubbed it the Star Wars phenomena, meaning that there's the good side and the dark side. And you pick kind of who you're going to do business with and who you're going to hang out with. And I don't think it's a matter necessarily of that person as much as a matter of focus. It's, this is a great business and the glass is half full. Whether you're an assistant, whether you're an agent, whether you're a manager, no matter what your role is, I really want to be here. This is what I want to do. Or the glass is half empty. There's never enough success for any of us. No one's going to survive this.
In order for me to succeed, you have to fail.
Exactly. So there are two ways to look at it. And I think that you make a choice, consciously or unconsciously, on how you're going to survive in the entertainment community. And then you go forward from there.
Do you think that you can be on the dark side and have a long and fruitful career?
Oh, yes.
Because to me, if you don't exhaust, I guess the thing is about Hollywood is that there is constant turnover.
Right.
So people forget how evil you may have been in the past.
Right.
Because if that was not true, if it was a business with a lot of longevity, people would just never work with you again. And you personally would become so, you know, burnt that from all the evilness that you wouldn't be able to continue. But that's just really not the way it is.
Yeah. No. And there are brilliant people on both.
What's interesting in this book, a nemesis, if there's kind of an evil character, it's this studio head named Arnold Murphy.
Right.
But he's so comical that you can't hate the guy, even though he's doing everything to destroy this woman and her career in Hollywood. His only motivation for trying to destroy her is a personal vendetta.
Right.
Do you think personal feelings are that strong in Hollywood? Do you think that people would really go that far to exercise a vendetta, even if they knew it was going to cost the studio a lot of money?
I think that walks a very fine line. I think that Hollywood brings out, or the entertainment industry brings out, the very best and the very worst in almost everyone that is part of the business. I don't know if someone would go quite that far, but I have seen projects killed for reasons that sometimes are a little bit questionable. Do you know? I mean, and I think everyone has experienced the times when there is a new regime at a studio and things that were going to go or very close are not going to go.
All right. Well, let's kind of go from there.
Sure.
What is in the book that you think really is true? Maybe even things that people would just assume are not true because they're so outrageous. And what are the things that are really creations of yours?
You know, I have not sat down and done that, so it could take me a little bit.
How about
the
closeness of these four women?
Oh, that is definitely true. I have friends like that, and I know other women that have friends like that. And I think that a lot of it, you know, touches on how the three of the four had shared loss together and had been friends for a very long time. And I found, especially coming up through the system of Hollywood, that you find close friends, and you know very quickly who is going to be your long-term friend that you can trust and who is going to be kind of a business associate, you know?
Right. So. Okay. On the flip side of that, what about just the lifestyle itself?
I think that probably is – that could be a weakness from the author, because in my in my mind, these women are very three-dimensional, and they do have – and maybe I kind of gloss over some of the bad aspects of their lives, because in this, you know, Celeste, she does dabble in drugs. She has a very unhappy marriage. She ends up getting divorced, and somebody has a porn tape of her. You know, I mean, those are dark things that they can happen to people. Jessica, her engagement falls apart. She had an affair with someone that she was mad for, but he was having affairs with other women.
I don't know. Maybe it's that in this day and age of Us Weekly, that those things are more like a soap opera that we watch and enjoy than we don't think about. Only when, you know, a Britney Spears shaves her head,
right,
do you start to see kind of the pathology of what goes on behind the scenes. It all seems like kind of a wonderful, you know, dream. And also from – I want to read the dedication,
okay,
in this book that says, "This book is dedicated to the entertainment community, a place where genius thrives, creativity flourishes, and dreams really do come true." So perhaps the author of this book is also just an optimist and somebody who sees all of this for what it is, maybe, which is, you know, the truth of the matter is, if you're very wealthy and powerful and you have bad things happen to you, you're not starving.
It's true.
You know?
It's completely true.
So maybe it's just a matter of you understanding the kind of – you have a little bit of a reality check of understanding what really is important.
Maybe. And it's not to say that there – like I've mentioned, there is darkness around us at all times. I think it's a conscious choice as to which to focus on. Entertainment does. It brings out the very worst and the very best in everyone who is kind of drawn to it. And I do believe that people are drawn to this business. It's like a siren song for some.
Film producer Maggie Marr was formerly an agent at ICM, and she's now the author of the deliciously salacious and sometimes true novel Hollywood Girls Club. Maggie, thanks for visiting us on The Business.
Thank you so much.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Rodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts covering politics, news, music, arts, and culture. For more details, visit kcrw.com.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from IFC Films, presenting the new film After the Wedding. Champagne is poured, secrets are spilled when a mysterious stranger arrives for a family wedding. In select theaters, March 30th.